Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and today I'm hosting New Books in Math. New Books in Math is a new channel on the New Books Network, and I'm happy to inaugurate it. Even though I am not a mathematician myself, I am married to one, so I feel like that somehow makes me qualified to do this. In actual fact, I do know a little bit about statistics, which is something we'll be talking about today, because we are very lucky to have here on our first podcast, Layla Schneps and Coralie Colmez on the show, and we'll be talking about their terrific new book, Math on Trial, How Numbers Get Used and Abused in the Courtroom. I read this book and I think it's absolutely terrific because it shows how mathematics has real-world significance that you can directly see. This is sort of beyond the behind-the-scenes stuff that you may be familiar with, but in this case, when it's used in trials or in legal matters, what we might call forensic mathematics. I don't even know if there is forensic mathematics. Maybe there should be. We'll talk about that. But here it actually matters. And I think that Layla and Coralie have done a terrific job of suggesting that we might want to take it a little bit more seriously. So I want to congratulate them on writing the book. Perhaps you folks could begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself. Layla, why don't you begin?
Okay. So I am 51. I was born in the States. I went to school in the States, in Boston, near Boston, actually. I graduated from Harvard, and I went to Europe to do my graduate work for fun because I thought that would be interesting, and stayed because you know how it is. You meet somebody, and I met Coralie's dad. Mm-hmm. And so I've been there ever since. And now I'm a professor at the University of Paris. I'm a professor of mathematics. Mm-hmm. I have a research position, and I usually work in pure mathematics. Mm-hmm. However, I've always been very interested by crime, both fictional crime and true crime. So I'm a big reader of mystery stories. Mm-hmm. And I've been a long-term follower of certain real crimes that are quite a bit in the news. Some of them are in the book. Mm-hmm. And somehow, one day, 2 or 3 years ago, the two things clicked together, and I came up with the idea of writing the book about mathematics and crime.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a terrific idea. Coralie, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Hi. So I'm 25, and I'm Layla's mom. I'm not sure if someone has actually said that yet. Mm-hmm. I'm Layla's daughter.
Yes, right.
So I was born in Paris and went to school there. But then when I finished school, I went to Cambridge University in England to do math. Mm-hmm. And I graduated about 3 years ago. And when I graduated, I had this very cool job, but it was only a temporary job. It was 1 year. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to do. And then when we were talking with my mom, she thinks that everyone should write a book. And so so we were thinking about, you know, what books to write. And we came up with this idea sort of together, and then we wrote it. It was actually quite nice because I was in Argentina when we were writing it on a long holiday, several months. Mm-hmm. So it was good to have, you know, something smart to do also.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's terrific. I mean, it's wonderful, as I said in the pre-interview, that mother and daughter could write a book together. I think that's an unusual thing to begin with, and it speaks of what I think is probably a good relationship. I won't weigh in on that, nor do I know but I do know the probability of it, and it's very low. At least that's my probably false estimate of it. So let's get right into the book. Why did you guys write this book? I mean, what actually sparked it? Layla mentioned a little bit that she was interested in some of this stuff, but what is the sort of cause behind this book? Layla, why don't you go ahead?
Yeah, for me, what it is I was following several cases that were really bothering me because, you know, sometimes the things going on in trials are things I can actually understand. When they start involving certain kinds of probability calculation and analysis, I can really understand what's going on. And then I was starting to see things that were not good. Mm-hmm. And I'm not the only one by far. Other mathematicians and statisticians were writing articles about some of these stories. And For the first time, I said to myself, I have to do something. It's not enough just to follow and to read and maybe to blog. I really need to join the movement of the very small, still brand new movement of mathematicians and statisticians who want to do something about this.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Coralie, would you like to continue that?
Yeah, I remember that around the time when we started thinking about the idea, we'd been reading a lot of popular science books like, Bad Science and Freakonomics and that type of thing. And we were thinking, you know, there isn't really something like that exists for maths. And we were just throwing around some ideas. And then since my mum follows so many of these cases, we realized that a lot of the things we were thinking about that we could talk in the book were criminal trials. And so we decided to focus mostly on those. Mm-hmm. And we found, we did a bit more research and found that there were actually very many of these things that had happened. Mm-hmm. So lots of material.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's intrinsic to the way in which our judicial system works, particularly in trials, because it all has to do with probability, even in cases of things like, let's say, eyewitness testimony. We know from experiments that eyewitness testimony is valuable in a certain percentage of the cases. Now, right. You can't get away. We live in a probabilistic world. It just there's no way of getting around it. And in cases like this, you're always, you know, when you talk about a circumstantial case, it rests on multiple probabilities. It's sort of like, you know, Bayesian paradise. It's because you have to.
It is.
You really have to know the situation well in order to get a good handle on the statistics, and that can be a tricky thing because as you point out in the book, in many cases, some statistical calculations are very what some people call counterintuitive. They don't seem at first to make a lot of sense, but then when you sort of explain it to people and you do the steps, then it does make sense. So let's talk a little bit about one of the things I really like about the book, and I really suggest people read it precisely for this reason, is that it's so well laid out. You talk about just a series of mathematical errors, and there are 9 of them. Let's just begin with the first one, multiplying non-independent probabilities. I know why you didn't use the word stochastic.
We also chose not to use the word Bayes.
Yeah, right. That's true. He shows up right at the end. So,
yeah, well, right. We minimized him.
Yeah. So what's the problem with multiplying non-independent probabilities, and what did it do to Sally Clark?
Mama, you want to start this one?
No, go ahead.
Okay. Well, the multiplying non-dependent probabilities will give you a final property that's much smaller than what it should actually be. So you have to be very, very careful. When you have two separate events that happen, you have to, before multiplying their probabilities, their individual probabilities, you have to be very careful that they are actually independent. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what didn't happen in the Sally Clark case. So Sally Clark was this woman in England who had two small children die of sudden death, so unexplained death. And the expert witness at the trial was Sir Roy Meadow, who was starting this big campaign against child abuse. And he started from all these studies about sudden infant death syndrome and the probability that one of them would happen in different types of family. And he said that in Sally's type of family, it would be something like 1 in 8,000. And he just squared that probability of one sudden infant death to find the probability of two sudden infant deaths. And he found, obviously, a very, very small probability, which he said must mean that Sally had actually killed her two children because it was so improbable that it would have happened naturally. But, I mean, he did this in the face of so many studies that follow families where one sudden infant death has already happened, and show how much more probable it is that another one will happen. All these studies, you know, definitely show that those two events are not independent. And no one knows exactly what factors may cause these, but there are probably some genetic ones, some, you know, social ones. So they are definitely not two independent events. So he definitely shouldn't have just squared the probability.
Mm-hmm. There's something we would call a confounding variable here. There's something lurking in the background that causes this, and people weren't looking at it. I mean, in the simple case of a coin toss or a fair dice, then these are independent things, and you can just multiply the probabilities. But here we have, I'm trying to think of a really good example. If you have a football team, that is in the English sense, that has a super football player on it and they win one game, it's not a 50% chance they're going to win the next one because they have somebody really good on the team.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And you got to take that into consideration. You know, Man United wins more often than not. So,
and, was so wrong about what Sir Roy Meadow did in particular was that he, when he squared those probabilities, he was acting as though a sudden infant death syndrome is a totally random event. Yeah. It can strike anywhere. But at the same time, he used a 1 in 8,000 figure, which only is the rate of sudden infant death syndrome in a family of Sally's social class. So she was a lawyer, and you know, she and her husband earned a good living, and they were non-smokers, and they were not under 26. And these are all factors that have been shown to play a role in sudden infant death syndrome. But that very fact means that it isn't a random occurrence. So that's all the more reason not to treat it as a random occurrence. And in fact, you get a double SIDS in England once every couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But he didn't, he tried to treat it as independent and non-independent at the same time in the worst possible way for Sally.
Yeah, right. Well, one of the things I explain to people and my students when I talk about statistics is that really improbable things happen all the time. You see what I mean? Like, these incredibly rare things happen all the time.
Because you have to multiply by the size of the population, right, and exactly. We're 6 billion people on Earth.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. So let's go on to error number two, which I am guilty of all the time, usually tendentiously, and that is unjustified estimates. How did unjustified estimates affect the life of Janet Collins? Who wants to go first?
Well, I'll go ahead. So this is actually a case which, if it hadn't actually sent people to jail, would be really funny.
Mm-hmm.
Because what happened was...
It's my favorite one, just because it's so funny.
It's a great story, although people did jail time for it, which is a bit sad. But what happened was that some eyewitnesses to a crime, and the crime was robbing of a handbag from an elderly woman who was thrown to the ground and her hip was broken. So I'm not saying that this was a minor crime.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, there were a couple of eyewitnesses who saw very briefly the girl who stole the bag run by and a guy pick her up in a car and drive off. And they noticed that the girl was blonde with a ponytail, the guy was black with a mustache and beard, and the car was yellow. But since no one had any clue who these people could be, what police did is to search all around the area for a couple matching that description. So they found such a couple, and then they wanted to prove that that was the right couple, and there was no other evidence really at all. I mean, the couple had a kind of alibi, but it wasn't really precise to the minute, and they could have squeezed in a robbery. There was just no evidence, but no real alibi either. So in the absence of everything, the prosecutor came up with this bright idea of phoning the local university and calling for a mathematician who came to render service to society without knowing what he was getting into. And up there on the stand, he was given some probabilities and told to multiply them. So that's all the mathematician had to do. And he wasn't given the chance to talk about multiplying independent probabilities. And the probabilities were probability of a woman having a blonde ponytail, probability of her husband being black, probability of a car being yellow, probability of a guy with a beard, a mustache. Only the probabilities for all of these different features that the prosecutor gave came off the top of his head. He said, okay, let's say one car in 10 is yellow. I should say this was taking place in 1964. And this was really the very beginning of the use of probability in trials and people starting to both use it and protest against it. So let's say one woman in 4 will wear a ponytail and so forth. And he said to the witness, take these numbers and multiply them. And then, of course, the probability came out to be, you know, 1 in several million.
Mm-hmm.
So then he said, okay, jury, it's got to be them. Can't be anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But he wasn't even calculating the right probability. He was calculating the probability that such a couple would exist in the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the probability that this couple you've got in front of you is that couple or the only couple of this kind.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, he just estimated the probabilities without any justification at all.
He pulled them out of
his head.
Thin air, let's say that. I wanted to say something
secretary
else.
The department before writing them down. And he also multiplied them, which, like the previous error, they're not at all independent. Like a guy having a mustache and a beard is not really independent.
No.
So he did everything wrong, basically.
Yeah, right. Poor guy. Coralie, do you want to weigh in on this one? Since you like it?
Yeah. I think there's a particularly, this has nothing to do with the maths or anything, but I think there's a particularly funny bit when the defense lawyer he actually has understood that the probabilities aren't independent. And he tries to explain it in a very funny way. He says stuff like, it's not independent for a blonde woman to be with a black man because blonde women are much more, much more daring than brunette.
And he's pulling, and basically behind that, he's pulling statistics out of thin air too. Yeah. It's much more likely that, you know, so everybody's basically making it up. Yeah, right. Yeah. That's
not... But it was early days in the 1960s.
Sure. No, I understand. But she, you know, but these people did some jail time though.
Yeah.
They did jail time. Yeah. And then on appeal, this judgment was canceled and the guy was let out of jail. As for the girl, I think she'd finished her jail time already. She didn't have that long a period, so she was already out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it is a sad thing. So anyway, math error number three, trying to get something from nothing. And the case of Joe Sneed, the wonderfully named Joe Sneed, who would like to take a crack at talking about that one.
So this one is actually fairly similar to the previous one. And in fact, the prosecutor for the Sneed case had phoned the prosecutor for our previous case.
So these aren't independent probabilities.
it's an imitation.
Yeah, it is. So yeah, he had phoned the prosecutor for the previous case because he'd read about what had happened in the papers and thought this sounded interesting and he could maybe use the same technique.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened here is that this elderly couple was found dead, and they were found dead by their son, Joe Sneed. And he wasn't a suspect in the beginning, but eventually when the police looked inside his car, because they did have to treat him as a suspect as he had found the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
So they looked inside his car. And they found a receipt that wasn't to the name of Joe Sneed. It was to the name of Robert Crossett. And when they had found that receipt, they were able to then find evidence that a man called Robert Crossett had done various things like buy a pistol and stayed in various inns on the way between where Joe Sneed lived and where his parents lived. And so what they were attempting to do was to prove that the Robert Crossett who had done all these things was all the same person to the Robert Crossett whose receipt was in Joe Sneed's car, and that the fact that the receipt was in Sneed's car indicated that he had actually used the name Robert Crossett.
Mm.
And so to do that, there were various probabilities. So Robert Crossett was described as having brown hair, brown eyes, so they found the probabilities of having brown hair and brown eyes, and then his height was described. So this was all when he had bought the pistol, because they, when you buy a pistol, you have to get described in the register. And there was one property in particular, which was of the name of the property of the name Crossett actually being used. And to calculate that property, they looked in a few phone books from the area, so quite a few of them, and they didn't find any Crossetts anywhere. And so the prosecutor just sort of said, right, well, we can't find any of them, so let's say the probability is 1 in a million. And this is completely ridiculous to sort of try to make up a probability like that when you have no indication of anything, and you have no idea if Crossett would maybe be a very common name in another part of the country or something like that.
Town, were they all one big family? Where they weren't looking in that particular phone book?
Sure, sure. Yeah, that makes absolute sense. So he was just making it up too.
He completely made it up. And the funny part of the story is that he had these phone books brought in from various places around the Southwest United States, and everyone in court was looking at them, including Joe Sneed himself, and the defenders and the prosecutors and the witnesses. Everybody was like flipping through phone books looking up Crossetts.
Wow.
Yeah, it must have been strange, but no one found any, and so he just made up this number.
Yeah, that's bad. Let's just say it.
Like I said, it was early days, though.
Yeah, right. So a little bit later, here we come to some medical evidence, and this one I thought was really interesting and pertinent, and that is math error number four, the double experiment, which gets into a really tricky thing, and that is the probability of false positives and false negatives. It's a very interesting thing. I've dealt with it just a little bit in the case of Meredith Kircher. Who'd like to talk about her?
I'll talk about her.
Okay.
So first of all, it's I've noticed while researching the case of Meredith Kircher that the mathematics used for DNA analysis is not advanced enough. it's very crude, in fact. I really, really think that DNA specialists need to hire a bunch of good statisticians. No, seriously. One thing that they use, and this was repeated many, many times during both trials of Amanda Knox and her boyfriend, is that, so you know when you run a DNA sample, you get a graph with peaks, and those peaks are located in the places of the given individual, and they're very different from individual to individual, and that's how you get an identification. The more DNA you have, the higher the peaks. If your DNA is very, if the sample you're looking at is tiny, the peaks are low. And the trouble, they say, is that the machine that analyzes these samples produces background noise. So it's got a little row of tiny peaks at the bottom of the graph always. Mm-hmm. But when your real peaks are low, they could be background peaks.
Right.
You have to distinguish them. And what you need to have is a statistical analysis that studies the peaks you have with respect to the average background peaks to pick out which ones are the real ones. Mm-hmm. But they don't have this. All they say is, okay, below a certain height, really kind of arbitrary, below 50 RFU relative fluorescent units, this is how you measure the height of DNA peaks. We'll just not look at them. We won't count them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is terrible because, so they took a swab of this knife that was found in Amanda Knox's boyfriend's apartment where Meredith Kircher had never been. It was carried to the lab. A lot of people have said this could be contamination, but when you think about it, it was found in his house where she never was by white-suited people with gloves. It was bagged, they said, in a paper envelope that wasn't the right kind, but, you know, it didn't have Meredith's DNA on it either. It was brought to this lab, which was full of DNA of all the many criminals that are tested in this lab. So if any contamination got onto that knife, you can't see how it could have been Meredith's of all people, the mm-hmm. person that was being tested for. So for me, I'm very inclined to believe that the swab of the knife came from the knife, because where on earth would the contamination have come from? And so it's Meredith's DNA, and but the quantity was tiny, tiny. And so the peaks are low. But it just so happens that in that sample, the background peaks are very low. And the peaks of Meredith stand out very clearly. And what we did in the book is we laid it over a proper graph of her DNA from a good sample. And they are identical,
mm-hmm.
except the good sample has high peaks and this sample has low peaks.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's really hard to do because the science simply hasn't caught up to DNA analysis yet, is to give a probability that the low copy number, this is a tiny sample, really is Meredith, given the accepted unreliability of this tiny kind of sample because of the background peaks. Mm-hmm. It's hard to quantify it because you look at the graph here, you're going to say it's 99.9% sure that it's her. It is her. You look at the rule that says you cannot use peaks under 50, you have to say, well, we can't distinguish these peaks from background peaks.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole science of calculating the probability of whether background peaks could show up exactly in the places where her peaks are, that's a science that hasn't completely been done yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a ballpark figure about 80% certainty that it was hers. It looks exactly like hers, right? But I cannot accept it to be as reliable as a full-size sample.
Mm-hmm.
So the point here is we have this sample, and I'm taking this ballpark figure of 80% reliable than hers, although really I believe it's more reliable than that. But, you know, there's this limit due to the present state of the science. And the judge in the appeal trial of Amanda Knox and her boyfriend, Raffaele, was asked to retest the knife because nowadays, which is 5 years after the original, well, the appeal was 4 years after the crime, there are techniques that can analyze even smaller samples than at the time. So even if one cell was left, it could be tested now.
Mm-hmm.
And he said no. And he said no, and he explains his reasoning very clearly because in Italy, when you judge a case like this, you have to write a very complete explanation of your decision, which is great because then we get to understand what they're thinking. And he explicitly explains why he refused this test. And he said, if you have a test, but we can't accept it as reliable because it's too small, the sample's too small, and we do a second test, and the sample is even smaller, it's not going to be any more reliable, so we haven't gained anything. There's no point doing a second test.
Mm-hmm.
And this is completely, completely wrong from a mathematical point of view. If you do a test and get a result that's 80% reliable, and you do a second test and get the same result, you increase your reliability to way over 90%.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you should have done a second test. It's clear, both to double-check that the DNA really did come from the knife and not contamination, and to increase the reliability of the result.
Mm-hmm.
So his reasoning there is wrong. And to me, he made a great error not allowing a second test.
Yeah, this one is baffling to me because statisticians, I mean, people know a little bit about survey techniques. And mm-hmm. statisticians will often take two or three samples.
Well, of course.
And compare them just to see, you know, just to see exactly how they're doing. And it's intuitive that you would do this. And I, yeah. Yeah, this one, that one is mind
you know, if it hadn't written explicitly, a new sample would still be unreliable. I would never have believed that was his reasoning.
Yeah.
I would have thought he was thinking in much more general terms, all the other evidence shows he's innocent or whatever he wanted to say. But he wrote this out completely explicitly. And when I saw that, you know, this was while we were writing the book. And I was hesitating about to use the Amanda Knox case for a different reason. I was really annoyed to continually hear in the news in the States about this DNA sample being called a really poor match for Meredith, a 1% match. There's more chance that it could be my DNA than hers.
Yeah.
And I had this graph in front of me, and this is her DNA, and it's ridiculous. And I was actually wondering whether to put that in the book, but I wasn't going to do it because it's the media. It's not the trial.
Right. Right.
But it is a misuse of math.
Right. Once they get out into the press, then all bets are off to use
it. Yeah, right. Then the judge came along and said this really just astounding piece of misreasoning. And so the case got into the book.
Yeah, right. Well, it's a good one and it's a sad one. Let's go on to the birthday problem. The birthday problem is a classic of all mathematics classes throughout the world, I think. Doesn't everybody do the birthday thing? Because it is kind of shockingly counterintuitive. And it had an impact on Diana Sylvester. Who'd like to take that one?
So the birthday problem is about how many people you need to put in a room to have a 50% chance of them sharing a birthday. And the answer is very small. It's 26, 23?
23.
I think it's 23, yeah.
And which is very counterintuitive, but the reason is because what's important here is not the number of people, but the number of pairs of people, because sharing a birthday corresponds to a pair of people.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask the question now, how many people do I need to put in a room for them to match a specific birthday, like the 1st of January, then the answer is much bigger. It's 253 or so.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to realize that those questions are actually completely different from one another.
Yeah.
Matching a specific birthday or just having, having whichever birthday in common.
Mm-hmm.
And the Diana Sylvester case is it's a murder that happened a very long time ago in the 70s, and the murderer was never caught, but the file did contain a sperm sample from the murderer. And many years later, when after DNA analysis had started, had started existing, they decided to reopen this case and test the sperm sample against their database of sex offenders. This was all in California. And the sperm sample from the file was very degraded. So a normal, a good quality sperm sample has 13 pairs of peaks that you would compare it to any other sample on. And this one had only five full pairs and then some, maybe a half of another one. And there are probabilities associated to degraded samples like this. So, for example, a sample that's only has only five pairs of peaks, the probability is about 1 in 1,000,000 that you would find a person who matched that sample on those five pairs. So obviously, when you have only five pairs of peaks, you have no idea if you find a match, you have no idea if it would actually match on the remaining pairs of peaks. The only thing you know is if it matches on those particular pairs of peaks.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ran it on the database, and they did find a match. And this match was an old man who had been convicted for a few other rapes back in the 1970s. But he was now very old, and he was adamant that he hadn't done it. And he sort of, they found pictures of him at that time. He sort of matched the description of the murderer that had been made, but sort of didn't as well. And there wasn't basically much evidence apart from the fact that the five peaks of the murderer matched five of his peaks. The probability of that happening was estimated to be about 1 in 1,000,000.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a big argument between the defense team and the prosecution team, because the defense team had read these studies that, about people having matching DNA profiles in big databases. And the studies had found that actually there were quite a lot of people matching on, you know, as many as 9, 10, or 11 peaks who weren't related at all, but were still matching. And the defense took this to mean that the estimated random match probability, so the probabilities that the FBI has, were matching on a smaller number of peaks, were actually completely wrong. And that the 1 in 1,000,000 was actually a completely wrong probability. And the mistake they were making there was exactly the birthday problem. Because, of course, if you have a big database matching, you know, having two profiles matching, it's not at all the same as running a specific profile through the database and finding a match to that profile.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's the birthday problem.
It's exactly the birthday problem. So when they were saying that the probabilities, the random match probabilities were wrong, they were actually misunderstanding what was happening, you know, which question of the birthday problem they mm-hmm. were having to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this one, I think, has to do with people misunderstanding nonlinear phenomena. That is, they don't quite get things that don't go in a stepwise fashion.
Yeah, this is actually one of the most counterintuitive of all problems, I think.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But it's the pairs that is the thing. The pairs increase.
Yeah, pairs is the thing, right?
Very quickly as the number goes up.
Exactly.
Yeah, but that's sort of hard to put in your mind, you know? It's just hard.
So there's so many pairs in even a small population.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it kind of confuses me in a certain sense until you realize that the unit is the pair.
Right.
The number of pairs increases really quickly as you add individuals, then I think that it makes a little bit more sense. That's a very tough one, and it is counterintuitive. So let's move on to number six. I liked your, this is a Simpson's paradox. I liked your description of the University of California, Berkeley. I was a graduate student at the University of California, Berkeley, and I'm here to tell you it is not paradise. not at all. In no
because
way
you
is
have
it paradise.
You. It looks like paradise from the outset. I've actually visited there more than once, and actually Coralie's been visiting there with me.
Yeah.
But as visitors, you agree with this, Coralie? It's just amazing.
It looks like paradise, but it's not. Not at all. So anyway, talk a little bit about Simpson's paradox. This is an interesting one, the Berkeley sex bias case.
Yeah, I actually love Simpson's paradox. I think this is one of the most amazing phenomena that you get in this kind of simple statistics that can completely fool people, including mathematicians, including us, is that there are a lot of cases like this where you can say something that sounds like a total, total paradox, and yet it's just true. And a really simple example would be, say, you might have some national kind of testing, and in New York could say, say you have an English test, and New Yorkers would say, well, our first language speakers and our second language English as a second language speakers both scored better than Nebraska's on this test. Mm-hmm. And Nebraska could say, but our average score is higher than New York on this test.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems completely crazy that both things can be true, but they can both be true. And it's always what you called a confounding variable earlier, because there's something else going on that you have to take into account. And in the case of the test, for instance, it could be that the English as a second language speakers are far more numerous in New York than they are in Nebraska, and that even though their scores are higher than those of Nebraska, there's so many more of them, and their scores might be lower than the English native speaker scores.
Mm-hmm.
And that would bring the average overall average down, mm-hmm. although each group is higher.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened in the Berkeley case with sex discrimination, where they really thought that a lot of men candidates to grad school were being accepted and very few women. And when they narrowed it down to groups, the way I just did with the speakers of English speakers, they found that in fact each group was very equal and maybe even advantaging women. But before they narrowed it down to groups and studied the statistics, it looked like there was a huge sex bias going on at Berkeley. And the point we were making in the chapter is that Berkeley has undergone a lot of accusations of sex bias and looked into an individual case, because it could be that if these individual cases didn't happen, nobody would have suspected Berkeley of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So can you touched on that particular case, though, that there was just no sex bias whatsoever going on.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you explain in a little more depth? I mean, one of the things that is interesting, you mentioned at the end of that chapter, is this the fact of the matter is that very few women apply to in this case, become professors.
Or
to graduate school.
To graduate school, even in certain departments like math and engineering.
Right.
Very few women apply. Loads of women apply in many other departments. And this is exactly the hidden variable that was skewing the whole count. The reason that fewer women were being accepted was because math and engineering departments accept a lot of students, but there just aren't very many applicants.
Very many women,
Whereas many women applicants are applying to hard to get into departments that don't accept many students, like humanities.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, what we ended up finding is that there is a sex bias, but it's not, you know, Berkeley, the University of Berkeley is not the one to blame.
Mm-hmm.
It's a much more generic sex bias. There's something going on in society somewhere, which is making the number of girls applying to grad school in math and engineering very low.
Right.
Although Coralie and I obviously studied math and loved it.
Right.
Not a good example of this.
Yeah, there's some sort of self-sorting going on before that level.
And that's a very deep question, but the University of California is not to blame.
Not to blame for that self-sorting. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And it's sort of interesting, but it does raise another set of questions. Why do people sort in this way?
Yeah, it's very, very interesting and complex.
Well, I know that I have a young daughter, and she for whatever reason, really likes Barbie dolls and pink and princess dresses, and we cannot figure it out for the life of us.
I think that doesn't contradict her liking math, though.
No, not at all. But it's just, I got to tell you, we did nothing. As far as I can tell, we did nothing to encourage this, but all of a sudden it just appeared. And I was like, I don't know what's going on there. I can figure it out. I'm sure she'll be great at math. I have no doubt about it.
Too.
I have no doubt she'll be great at math. But
her parents, you know?
Yeah, that's right. How this happened, I do not know. So let's move on to the next one, which is the incredible coincidence. This is one of my favorites, because incredible coincidences usually aren't that incredible. Luca de Berk, can you talk a little bit, or Lucia, is it?
Lucia
de Berk, yeah. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So Lucia was this nurse in The Hague, and she had been present at quite a lot of deaths or, you know, incidents. Yeah. And her colleagues got very suspicious of her. And the director of the hospital made this little, you know, table in Excel to try to see how probable it was that she would have been present at all these deaths and incidents just by chance. And he calculated something called the p-value of the table, which tells you basically how likely it is to happen naturally. And he found a very, very tiny p-value. And he was like, oh, my God, this can't have happened naturally. She must have killed these people. And he went on a very, very quick and decisive, you know, he just took very quick action against her. So he called the police, he called the newspapers, he apologized to all the parents and stuff like that. And the same operation that he had done himself was also done at the trial by the expert witness, who wasn't much of an expert. So this expert witness calculated once again the p-value corresponding to all the events that Lucia had been present at. And he found once again this very tiny p-value that seemed to indicate that it was a completely unnatural thing to happen. But the problem was that the whole case, nothing was clear cut in the case, and it kept changing, and no one bothered revising the, you know, the calculation of the p-value. And so things happened like when it was known that Lucia had been present at a death, that death was classified as not natural, but when they subsequently learned that actually she hadn't been present, it was reclassified as natural. And it was all basically, because it had started with her being suspected, everything was viewed in that light. Everything was viewed in the light that she was the suspect. And so nothing was viewed objectively. And so the table, the Excel table, kept changing, and no one ever bothered recalculating the p-value.
Mm-hmm.
Corresponding to the new tables or anything. And no one bothered realizing that there didn't seem to be anything that was actually suspicious. The only thing that was suspicious was whether she had been present or not. And the events, none of them had been categorized as suspicious at the time or anything. So it was all being skewed by them thinking that she was suspicious from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. So they backfitted the data sort of unwittingly.
Yeah, they did. I believe they did this unconsciously. I really don't think they were framing her, but they did exactly what you said.
Yeah, that's right. And here we have something that I think is intuitive, and that is the expected result. And this is something we use every day. When we flip a coin, we expect, if it's fair, that we're going to get, basically, it's going to be 50-50, or it's going to be 1 in 2, however you want to put it. And then when you get a run, you begin to wonder, since it's counter to the expected result, whether it's fair or not.
Right. Yeah.
But the counterintuitive thing is, for me, is that if you flip enough coins, you're going to get one of those runs every time. Every single time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's always going to happen that you're going to get 6 heads in a row if you flip enough.
Right.
So that, and then that expected result, once you have it firmly in your mind that it is biased or not biased, then you start to backfit the data.
Yes.
You jump to a conclusion about it. And then you begin to see everything in a different light. And that's what happened to this poor woman, I think.
A lot of bad things came together with her. They multiplied. They did all basically a combination of the previous errors. They multiplied data from different hospitals.
Yeah.
They did a lot of things against her. And then they would ask her these leading questions in court, like, are you maybe just a bad nurse?
Right.
She would say, well, no, I'm not a bad nurse. But what they were trying to say was, maybe you were a bad nurse and that would explain it. We could acquit you. They were leading. But she refused to admit being a bad nurse. Yeah. She just said, no, it happened by chance. And there was no other evidence against her that any of these patients had been murdered at all.
Yeah.
And what I really love about this case is one of the ones I followed very closely is that she was, okay, so she was convicted to life in prison and she was reconvicted at both appeals. And she was saved by a bunch of statisticians, a bunch of university professors at the university in the Netherlands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, statisticians to the rescue.
Yeah. See, and it's really that case that made me think they're doing something I can do something to.
Forensic statistics. I like it very much.
It does exist. It actually does. And it's going to become a household word, I think.
I hope that I absolutely hope that it will. I should say that right here in Massachusetts, from where I am speaking right now, we had a fellow who in 1 year won the lottery twice.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And the lottery is not rigged, and everybody knows it.
Right, but so, did he buy a lot of tickets? Because some people do.
Yeah, he bought a lot of tickets. Yeah. Right. But still, it was an incredible, a true wacky coincidence. But if it's going to happen. It's going to happen all the time. That's the counterintuitive part, that unlikely things will always happen all the time. Yeah. And that's kind of confusing. So let's go on.
What happened to Lucia with the bunch of deaths and incidents that she witnessed at the hospital isn't that rare. This is going to happen to a few nurses in every country.
Right. There are a lot of nurses in a lot of hospitals.
Yeah, exactly. You have to multiply by the number of nurses
for
sure.
Right. So anyway, the next one, which I love because, it's about the most American of Americans, Charles Ponzi.
Yeah.
and I say that loving America, but is he an American. Underestimation, or as a friend of mine might say, misunderestimation.
Yeah.
Okay, who would like to talk about that one?
So I'll go for Ponzi. Ponzi is, it's a very simple case and it's very famous. By now, it's very famous because of Bernie Madoff, and everybody knows what a Ponzi scheme is now. It means that you convince investors that you have an absolutely fabulous investment that's going to double their money in a short time, and they rush over and give you their money, and you pay them the interest. You do double it. And the way you're doing it is obviously to persuade more and more investors and use their money to pay back the other guys.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole point of the operation is that you're always skimming money off to buy yourself a beautiful house, car, pool, diamonds, and furs. And that one day you will not be able to find enough new investors to pay back the other ones and everything will crash. And at that point you flee to the Bahamas.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what Ponzi was doing. And what we analyze in the chapter is that every single person who invested with him ought to have known, because the calculation is so simple. It was much simpler in those days. Madoff had a whole bunch of, hedge funds, but Ponzi just had the one thing, which he wasn't doing, but it was fake. But he said he had the one thing. And he said, I will double your money every 90 days. And it's so quick to calculate that if you do that, you've got the, you know, the entire United States budget in a few years. Yeah, you've got right. the entire United States population in a very few months. So there right. was no way it could go on.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, sometimes in statistics class, people will use the example of adding one nickel on top of another and then doubling them. And how long does it take to get to the moon? It actually yes. doesn't take you very long at all.
Exponential increase. Yeah. It's super fast.
Right. And but people don't, it's very counterintuitive. People don't, outside biologists, I think they get it. Or people yeah. who are having children, I think they get it.
Yeah.
but it's,
yeah, the kids go up linearly, but the trouble goes up exponentially.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, and also, there's another bit of common sense here, which Americans don't often have, and that is, if a deal sounds too good to be true, it's too good to be true.
that's
the way it is, man.
I mean, but Ponzi, I mean, there's a psychology to his chapter. He was just a master of the dream. You know, he really made people dream, and they really loved him. So that's how he did it.
Yeah, no, that's right. So then the next one you deal with, mathematical error number 9, is choosing the wrong model. This one is interesting. Hedy Green, the great Hedy Green.
Hedy Green. I like this one a lot as well for, you know, character reasons. So Hedy was, well, she was from quite a wealthy family. She had a wealthy father who was an investor, and he taught her everything from when she was a very small child. She was his only daughter, and he taught her everything, and she was very obsessed with money from a very young age. And, you know, she knew exactly how everything worked, and she really wanted to be an investor. And, she opened her account as soon as she could and everything. And when her father died, he left her his money, but he left it all in a trust. And she was very, very upset about this. That, you know,
and by men.
Yeah, he was sort of saying that he didn't really think that she could deal with her own money, and that she had to have these men to deal with her money for her.
Mm-hmm.
And so she wanted to make sure that when her aunt from the other side of the family, her mom's side of the family, who was also very wealthy and very ill, she wanted to make sure that when her aunt died, the same thing didn't happen again. The problem is that she didn't go about it in the best way, because she went to see her aunt and she sort of tried to force her to write this will, and you know, there was lots of screaming and arguments. but anyway, she eventually got her aunt to write a will giving all her money to Hedy. Then Hedy went back home. And then she started hearing that her aunt, who was very ill, had got this new doctor who was giving her lots of drugs, like laudanum. Is that how you say it?
Laudanum, sure. Yeah.
You know, that they keep you in a very, well, basically they're drugs. And she got quite upset, and then she heard that her aunt was, you know, really very much under the influence of this guy. And then she got a letter from the doctor himself saying that she, Hedy, was no longer welcome at the house of her aunt, and there wasn't really much she could do. And then when her aunt died, it came out that she had written a new will, giving a lot of money to the doctor himself and to other people, and leaving some money to Hedy, but also in a trust.
Where the doctor was the trustee.
Exactly, the doctor was the trustee. So basically everything that could have gone wrong had gone wrong. And so Hedy was incredibly upset about this. And she went back to her aunt's house, found the old will that they had written together, and declared that actually there was a secret page to the will that no one had seen before. And the page said, it had been written by Hedy because her aunt was too ill to write. And it had been written by Hedy, and it said, this will is the last true one I will ever make. If I make another one, it should not be considered valid. I'm afraid because I'm ill, and I'm afraid that people will try to take advantage of me. And then it was signed by her aunt. And no one had ever seen this, no witnesses or anything. And Hedy presented it at the trial, and the opposing side said that it was a fake and that the signature was a fake. And so they started trying to prove, so on Hedy's side that it wasn't, that the signature wasn't fake, and on the opposite side that it was fake. And they had all these very, very eminent experts help in this.
It's just amazing the people who they called to the trial. Oliver Wendell Holmes, Louis Agassiz, and the most famous, all the famous professors from Harvard were actually testifying at this trial, whether they could see pencil tracings under the signature or whether then, you know, the lines were a bit trembly, they the way they might be if you were tracing. And
how did the brain trust? How did the geniuses do?
They were opposing each other. They were not all on the same side.
The thing was that there was no actual of the normal proofs of tracing or anything. They had to find another way to prove that it was a fake. And the way they did that was by comparing. So they compared the signature on the secret page to the signature on
all other documents.
Yeah.
They just got every signature of her they could find, and they compared.
What had happened was that the signature on the secret page was exactly the same as the signature on the document that the aunt had signed just before. Mm-hmm. And the accusation was trying to prove that this would be completely impossible to happen naturally. It must have happened because the signature had been traced. It was completely impossible to, you know, to make your signature be exactly the same twice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they did that by comparing the signatures, well, all the signatures they could find of the aunt, and seeing how similar they were. And they came up with this model to describe the similarity between two signatures. And the problem with this model is that it actually relied on signatures being, just random, basically. And it doesn't take into account the fact that a signature can change over time. So signatures that are made close together will be more similar than, you know, some that were made years before, or using the same pen, or being at the same table, stuff like that. It doesn't take any of that into account. And you can actually see that the model wasn't correct, the model they used, because if you compare the model to this number of similar signatures that they actually found, it doesn't really fit. They were actually much more similar signatures than the model would have expected. Mm-hmm. But you know, no one raises at all. And so basically they said, you know, from our model, the probability that two signatures would be exactly the same is one in many millions. So it's impossible.
No, billion, trillions, quadrillions, impossible. That's what they said. So she lost her case.
Yeah.
She did. But she still became very rich, so.
Yeah, right.
And very famous. Yeah, yeah, very, very famous at her time.
Also, you know, when I was reading it, I was wondering, like, isn't it sort of included in the definition of a signature that it's not supposed to be random? It's supposed to identify you and uniquely you?
Yeah, of course, of course. The trouble was that this signature really was absolutely identical to one of the other signatures. Yeah. So that is a bit suspicious. Of course, we think so too. We're not actually judging, you know, whether it was or not. We're just saying the math was really not that legitimate.
Right. I gotcha. Okay, so the last case you deal with, number 10, the most famous of all these cases. I even interviewed a woman who wrote a book about it, and that is the case of the Dreyfus Affair. And you call it mathematical madness. Please go ahead. I was surprised to see Dreyfus in the book.
The thing is that the mathematics in this case is so completely over the top and just crazy that we tried to just pick out two little bits of it to show some interesting applications of math gone wrong. But we just picked out two little bits out of a mass of totally insane mathematical ramblings. I love the story of Dreyfus. It's just an incredible story with so many ramifications and, you know, overturns and ins and outs and unbelievable things going on. It's totally a story worth telling. But I don't think people realize how, I'm not going to say mathematics played a role in his conviction. It was the fact that nobody could understand the mathematics that played a role. So the guy who did the mathematics was one of the handwriting analysts, and he had to prove that this document that a spy had written was in Dreyfus's handwriting. That was the whole basis. And they were going to convict him for treason and send him to Devil's Island. Mm-hmm. And it was all in the handwriting analysis because this was the only proof they had against him. There was nothing else, just this document and a similar handwriting to his. And the handwriting analyst was a very, very famous and respected person, Bertillon. He had developed a way to identify criminals that was being used all over at the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries. In fact, Ponzi was caught with Bertillon's system when he fled. And he was also the first person ever to use fingerprints to catch criminals. And he was basically a great criminologist. And people really believed him. Mm-hmm. But when he tried to prove that Dreyfus's handwriting was the one of the spy document, he went nuts. And he developed an unbelievably complicated and completely insane theory that he spouted in front of the court for like 2 hours. And nobody could understand it. And that played a role in the conviction. So there was no way we could explain all his ramblings. We picked out two particular instances of crazy things he said and explained them clearly.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't like the kind of surprising thing. It wasn't like the French at the end of the 19th and early 20th century had a weak mathematical culture.
No, they had very strong, but that's just it. That's why this guy in front of, you know, a bunch of a military jury at court-martial, they respected him exactly for that reason.
Yeah, they could have gone a lot of places and found people that really knew a lot about this, but they didn't, I guess, do that.
And he must have had an amazing charisma like Ponzi.
Yeah, yeah, no, I suspect that's right. Well, yeah, that's another sad one. So those are the 10. You conclude the book by talking a little bit about how and whether math should be used in the courtroom. And you talk a little bit about Lawrence Tribe, who says basically that it's just too confusing for normal folks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then you weigh in. What do you guys think?
Well, we definitely don't believe that, right?
Yeah, no, you don't. I think that's right. Why don't you believe it? I mean, some of these things are kind of hard to wrap your mind around.
Well, here's the thing. We belong to a team, so what I'm going to say is not just our own personal words. It's the philosophy of the team that we're working with, which believes that mathematics should be allowed into the courtroom in a very, very controlled situations. And certain reasonings, basically, essentially Bayesian reasoning. In fact, that's going to come up again. But the thing is, if the situation in which math can be used and the type of math that can be used are completely well-defined in advance, and if everybody can learn them because they are really not that hard, I think that it can work. It's things that should be taught in high school, I really think.
Mm-hmm. Carly, do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I mean, it would be silly to forget about, you know, a whole bunch of things that could actually help with the trial just because some people, you know, haven't been taught how to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I quite agree with you. One of the things that I would always argue with my historian colleagues who didn't like quantification very much is that they're already doing it. They're just doing it in a folk way. That is, they will use quantitative language, but they refuse to strenuously quantify things. So, for example, yeah, they'll say more or less or perhaps or it's probable that or maybe or, you know, all this language we have is a kind of it's Bayesianism in our language.
Mm-hmm.
But we people do not want to kind of take the hard look at it and try to move from what are probably pretty good intuitive notions built into the way we speak about probabilities to what we know technically about probability, which, as you say, it really isn't that complicated, especially in an era like ours. I mean, banking has done wonders for people's understanding of mathematics.
Yeah, no, there's nothing here that people couldn't be studying in high school. And in fact, I am all for a Bayes theorem and basic ability to enter the high schools.
Yeah, I mean, we use it all the time. I mean, this is the way we reason. We live in a probabilistic universe, whether we like it or not.
We use it all the time, and we make this kind of estimation and guess all the time. But again, we often do it wrong because our intuition's not always right.
Yeah, and that's why we probably need experts to do this. So how do we get these experts into the courtroom? Do we need a class of mathematical priestesses to so completely objective?
They're already there. They are already there. What you have to do is very simple. Firstly, make sure your expert witnesses really are experts, so not like the case of Lucia de Berg, where they got a non-professional statistician to do the calculation. And secondly, have a sufficiently educated public from which you draw your jury pool to understand it. I think that's all that's necessary.
Yeah, that's not going to happen in the United States. Because I got to tell you, if you're in a jury pool, and I have been, and you say you have a PhD or higher education, you're off immediately.
I tell you, I think these things should be in the high schools. I really believe this.
No, I agree with you too. So from your lips to God's ears, I want to thank you both, Layla and Corley, for being on the show. We've been talking about this wonderful book, Math on Trial, How Numbers Get Used and Abused in the Courtroom. I very much encourage everybody to go out and buy it. And Layla and Corley, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.